This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Dr. Roby Barrett, scholar at Middle East Institute, joins us. He is the president of a consulting firm specializing in defense and security technology applications and systems about what's going on in Turkey. From the outside looking in, it almost looks as if we have positioned ourselves into our own corner. Erdogan calls Trump's bluff, and it looks like he's now weaponizing refugees as well, and these issues seem to be stacking up. Dr. Roby Barrett, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
So Syria in and of itself is not a country, I guess, is it fair to say, that is important strategically to the U.S.?
Well, Syria in and of itself occupies a piece of territory that's strategically important to the U.S. I did a study for Special Operations Command some years back on Syria, Iraq, and what I call the collapse of the colonial construct in the Levant. And basically, post-World War I, the British and French decided what the Levant would look like. And you'll see references to it all over the place, drew lines in the sand, so to speak. And it divided peoples, ignored ethnicity and sectarian things. And the outgrowth of that were the two dictatorships, the two Ba'athist dictatorships. Interestingly enough, the one in Syria was a Shia dominator, or offshoot Shia. The Alawites really aren't Shia, they're offshoot. And then the one in Iraq was a Sunni-dominated dictatorship. And both groups in the area created represented minority. And so as a result, you have this volatile situation where the Ottomans had kept the lid on it for 400 years. The British, French removed the Ottomans. And then it devolved into these dictatorships that's the only way they could rule, really. I mean, or only way they could maintain order. Now, you can argue they were much more brutal than they had to be. Perhaps. I don't think there's any doubt about that, the Assads and Saddam Hussein eventually. But, it's a really, really fragmented area in which political constructs don't fit the reality on the ground.
So where do we go from here? So, the Syrian Kurds have been strong allies of the U.S. in fighting ISIS. They are, what is it? I think the number is 20 million Kurds throughout Syria, Iraq, Turkey. I think it's some in Iran as well.
Iran. Yeah, there's a lot. There's many in Iran, too. Yeah.
So,
well,
where do we go from here? Because Erdogan, the president of Turkey, he's come right out and said, we view the Syrian Kurds as a terrorist organization.
Well, of course he does. And the reason he does is that I'm just going to do this briefly, but for 500 years, the Ottoman Turks ruled, and that whole area of eastern Turkey was always a problem spot for people trying to control it, a Turkish government trying to control it, whether that government was in Ankara or in Istanbul.
Right.
And that's because from World War I, and American promises about what they viewed as American promises about self-determination, the Kurds said, hey, we've got all these people. We're in these places. We should have our own state. And this is a threat to the integrity of Turkey. It's a threat to the integrity of Syria. It's a threat to the integrity of Iraq and Iran. And so all of them, their, quote, Kurdish problem is how to suppress Kurds. Now, if you're trying to leverage those four people, what you do is you support the Kurds. You come up with a policy that lets you use the Kurds, whether or not, even if you take moral issues out of it and what you owe somebody. You just look at it from a geopolitical point of view. The Kurds give you enormous leverages. Alliances and ties to the Kurds and support of the Kurds give you enormous leverage on Syria, Turkey, Iraq, and Iran. And so if you were a great power and wanted influence, why wouldn't you do that? The sad thing here is that after the fiasco of Iraq and the invasion itself was always high risk, the aftermath, the administration under Bremer, was just a total fiasco and created this. After all of these problems out there, we finally found a formula that at a reasonable cost with very low casualties works. And I don't think the president understood it at all. I still doesn't understand it. And so what he's done is the abandoning the Kurds and this formula that worked and gave us this influence is, as Kissinger once put it, it's worse than a crime. It's a mistake.
Right. And then you have the influence of Russia. It seems as though the Russians, Vladimir Putin, has tried to position himself as being one more of a little bit of a peacemaker, trying to bring the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, to the table. They have a role to play here as well, trying to create a situation of accord between Syria and them, Turkey, and Iraq as well. Is this his actual positioning and exploiting maybe what the president doesn't see that he does see?
Well, he sees the situation and he wants a different outcome. He wants an outcome where Russia is the broker. Russia is looked up to and kind of displaces whatever U.S. influence they have out there. I think he'll probably be frustrated in the end trying to do that. Putin is significantly more sophisticated than the guy we have at the top, okay? And, he's ex-KGB. And Putin understands that probably he's not going to get what he wants, but to have a role. Russia's greatly diminished in the world. You got 140 million people. The economy is shot. They're doing pretty good at producing weapons, and they're trying to modernize. But, as far as the country itself, almost all of the resources are in Siberia. And that area itself is not ethnically Russian. And so he's got his own minority problems right all the way around. And so so what he's trying to do merely is to be a player, an outsized player in the Middle East when he really doesn't have the resources or the reach to do it. He's managed to support the Assad regime, but that's about the extent of what he's been able to accomplish. And even that, we could argue, is a strain on an already broken economy in Russia. So he's really in there really to appear and to be a player as opposed to really thinking he can solve something. Russians have been dealing with this area for, 50 years or so in a serious fashion, maybe more than that.
And they're still licking their wounds in the aftermath of Afghanistan.
Yeah. And they're still licking their wounds. Actually, their relationship back in the 50s and 60s with Egypt eventually failed. Their relationship in the same period with the Iraqis, on again, off again, sometimes it failed. Their relationship with Iran, remember Russian intervention in the last century or century and a half in Iran, created chaos there. So no matter how, they may be partners of convenience at a certain time, but deep down under that, there's deep hostility and suspicion. And so I can't believe that he is delusional and thinks that he can actually fix things. But he wants to have a role, and he wants to be a player. And in light of all of Russia's other problems, it's a big distraction for the people. He can use it as an internal distraction in Russia. So why not do it?
One of the things I found interesting is that shortly thereafterwards, that Erdogan would go here, where he weaponizes refugees, understanding the trials and tribulations in the EU. Right now, in dealing with the immigration policy, not unlike the the challenges that we face here domestically, this must be a really volatile touchstone issue for the EU, for him to go to this so quickly and say, well, I'll just open these borders up and you're going to be facing a refugee problem like you've never faced before in the history of Western Europe.
Well, I'll say this about the EU and the refugee problem. The EU, there's a reason the great congresses of Europe never really worked, okay? And that's because the northern tier countries are fundamentally different from the southern tier countries. Mm-hmm. The Brits always have their own idea about who they should be or who they shouldn't be. You know, the Brexit thing is just an example of that. And then you had this, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, you had this, well, all the world's problems are going to go away and it's going to be, you know, we're going to have these open borders. And really, it's an economic thing that's driving it. And so I'm not surprised by that at all. Erdogan wants to run an authoritarian government that doesn't meet EU standards. I mean, Turkey had hopes of becoming a part of the EU, but because of the way Erdogan has handled politics and suppressed the press, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they don't qualify. And so now that door is closed to him. And so really the only thing he has left, and you have to remember that he's in a severely weakened political position as well, or weaker than certainly he has been in the last 25 years, in that the largest city is Istanbul, old Constantinople, but Istanbul voted the opposition in.
Right.
And so part of what he's doing is he's thrashing about for, once again, a distraction from his own domestic problem. And so he raises the Kurds and says, look what I'm doing. I'm suppressing the Kurds. They're terrorists. Well, the Kurds view the Turks as conquerors and oppressors on what should be Kurdish land. And so, you know, it's a situation where it provides a distraction from really more serious problems at home. For example, the Kurdish military was going to get the very, very latest F-35s, et cetera, because of their NATO status. And now they're not, because Erdogan went out on his own and bought Russian air defense missiles, which means their radars would be on, which could, in theory, compromise. They could use them to practice track on F-35. They could compromise, you know, this new U.S. weapon system. And so, I mean, he's got all kinds of problems. And it's because he's flailing around, his economy's sliding, and he's got political problems at home.
Dr. Bauer, can you stay with us a few more minutes?
Sure.
We got to get to a break. We'll be right back. When we come back, we'll talk about the tenuous relationship that the U.S. has had with Turkey for a number of years and why none of this is really aligning in the end. We'll be right back. We're back and we're talking to Dr. Roby Barrett, scholar at Middle East Institute. He also is the president of a consulting firm specializing in defense and security technology applications and systems. And Dr. Barrett is talking to us about this situation in Syria as it relates to Turkey. Even in spite of the fact that Turkey's been a NATO ally of the U.S. for a long, long time, it occurs to me that our relationship with them over the years has been about as clear as mud. Is that a fair characterization?
No, that's more than a fair characterization. I would say this, that it's a situational thing. In other words, if you picked out a set of years, say up until the collapse of the Soviet Union, there's no doubt that the relationship was really clear because of the long-term historical and geopolitical enmity between the Russian Empire, and call that the Soviet Union or the old Russian Empire, and the Turkish Empire, the old Ottoman Empire, or Turkey, okay? And so we were very much a necessity. That relationship was very much a necessity to hold down Europe's or hold down NATO's southern flank, but also old animosities there, and the Turks saw it as a necessity for their own survival. And much of that time, Turkey was ruled by a military government because the Ottomans were replaced by eventually Ataturk, Mustafa Kemal, and basically a secular military government is what emerged. What you've had since the collapse and the rise of the AK party and Erdogan there is you've had this Islamist party, and it's had all of the problems with the secularists, and it has its problems with democratic. And you know, allegedly after the military came democracy. Well, what's replaced it really is another authoritarian government run by Erdogan, because it's the only way he can be. He has so much opposition among the secularists and among the more modernized, Europeanized group. His heartland is really, and I know some of his senior advisors, his heartland is really in old Anatolia, old Turkey, kind of in the south of Ankara. Mm-hmm. And so it's more rural, it's less cosmopolitan. And so, you know, they're just hanging on to power the best way they can. And if one day it's the secularists, one day he's upset about, you know, there was a aborted military coup. The next day it's the Kurds, and that's because he's in a very, very precarious position, and he's doing whatever he needs to do to hold his own position there. And if we push democracy, or if we push secularism, or if we say, hey, you shouldn't be locking up, well, this all flies in the face of what he wants, and so it really, really complicates it. And so now he's in a mode, I think he's in enough trouble now. The EU thing collapsed. He's got problems with the EU. EU policy has made them somewhat vulnerable, but they can really crack down. And his economy is in trouble, so he's flailing around trying to get leverage. That's why he bought the Russian military equipment. He's trying to get leverage to get help from the Europeans without having to change his policies at all.
So would that play then to what seems to be President Trump's strategy is with the removal of these troops, is that he believes that he could garner more through economic threats, understanding the fragility of his leadership in Turkey today, that through economic sanctions, he might be in a better position to affect an outcome than simply having 1,500 to 1,800 troops in northern Syria?
Well, there's nothing like boots on the ground.
Well, I agree with you there.
Yeah, okay. You can sanction all you want to. How have sanctions worked out with North Korea? And then how have sanctions worked out with anybody? Okay.
But one would admit Turkey is a different creature than North Korea in many, many respects.
Well, no, but I'm just saying economic sanctions, okay, if we withdrew our forces from South Korea and put relied on economic sanctions in the case of North Korea, what do you think the result would be?
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying.
You see what I'm saying?
I missed it. Okay.
And so my point here is, though, that after all this turmoil for 15 years, and I've been heavily involved in it, I was in Iraq during the surge, 08, you know, it is unbelievable to me that for as little investment as it took, with almost no casualties, and somebody else doing the work for you, and you just providing the support, and in a place that strategically provides you with so much leverage on everybody around you, okay, that you would just unilaterally withdraw, it says to me that you have literally no concept of all of what you're looking at. It's kind of like you hang on to what you have, and then you talk about economic sanctions to get this to that. And then you've got some leverage.
And you remove the possibility of the force multiplier by having boots on the ground in conjunction with economic sanctions if you don't like the behavior, right?
And with people, exactly. And this shattered thing, the states aren't going to be restored there. No. The old construct is gone. And so for you to be able to have, and this is what's even more important, for you to be able to have allies, just as Turkey was really, really dependent on Europe and NATO for its survival after World War II because of the threat posed by the Soviet Union. For you to have leverage and be able to be the one providing the support and whatever else that allows a people who have had their own aspirations with all of their internal bickering, the Kurds are divided up into clans. And there's all this internal bickering too. But for all their internal bickering, they all believe that they should have a political entity that's their own. And they thought they would get it after World War One and Woodrow Wilson. They thought they were going to get it again in 75. And when we were using them to upset the balance of power in Iraq, and then Shaw pulled out and we pulled out and left them hanging again. This is the second time we've abandoned.
I thought it was the third time.
Well, maybe the third. I mean, you.
It may be. I don't know. You would know better than me.
Yeah. If you want to go back to the World War One, we'd probably find any number of instances in there. But you do this and you got this leverage and you just let it go after everything we've been through. Really, there's just absolutely at the top no comprehension.
Is there any potential resolution since the breakup of the Ottoman Empire? Because that was kind of the seminal act that really has set this off and running on so many different fronts. Is there a place, a common ground that we can come to and resolve this? I mean, when you think about the tentacles of the breakdown of this, how do you get to an end game?
Well, if you look at it, and this publication I have is actually online. It was used as a capstone in the intelligence course that I was soaking on for a while. It's called, let's see, Iraq, Syria, and the Collapse of the Colonial Construct. And you can find it online. There's an external publication that comes out of Joint Special Operations with it. And then my book has a whole section. My most recent book, The Gulf and Struggle for Hegemony, has a whole section in it on Iraq and Syria. But here's the real issue: is when the Ottoman Empire fell apart, the British when it collapsed, and all of these entities were created largely for colonial reasons, but also to the various groups vying for power in them. What really emerged is after the collapse, the removal of the French and the British, then merely imposed a system and used their allies to impose a system on the areas that they controlled. And sometimes they had revolts, sometimes they didn't. It was always a touch-and-go thing. And then after World War II, when we went to this, quote, self-determination thing, the only way these areas, they literally took the artificial lines drawn by the British and French and called them countries. That's literally what happened. And then what emerged from that is the Ottoman, or this overarching structure, was replaced by the dictatorships eventually. Yeah. And then in 2003, not understanding that, we went in and destroyed the dictatorships. And as a result, you've got what you've got. You have, I laugh and say, I say you have the Ottoman Levant without the Ottomans. In other words, you've got the Levant without the control, right? And so the only people, and they're kind of a unique case, the only people that have kind of seen through this, actually, and come up with something that's an uneasy peace, will probably blow up tomorrow again, is that the Lebanese fought that civil war for almost 15 years, killing each other wholesale, right?
Right.
And then they looked around and said, well, maybe we ought to try to work something out here. It's probably more important to make money and do whatever else.
And now they're more stable than most.
And so it's not, I don't call it stability, and they certainly, well, yeah, but you're right. They are more stable than most. And everybody's got a piece of the pie, and now the Shia have their piece, et cetera, which they didn't have before. And so I think that all you're going to come up with is a series of uneasy equilibriums across the region. And I think that our position in Iraq, Syria, and Syria with the Kurds, and it wasn't just Kurds up there. there were a lot of Arabs that were a part of this, too, gave us leverage on everyone and also allowed a level of stability that gave these people a life, the potential for a life, and at a really, really low cost. The problem is that we always conducted Middle East policy on something we could afford. And even in the first Gulf War, with all of the hundreds of thousands of troops we sent to the Gulf, we actually made money on that war because the Arabs paid us for it. Okay? Actually, the end result was we made money on the 1990-1991 Gulf War. Yeah. But when we decided to go it alone in 2003, and then we literally destroyed Iraq because the people sent to administer it didn't understand the construct on the ground or how it had been done. Then we've created this huge problem for us. And now after, more than a decade or 15 years, we finally came up with something we could afford that gave us enormous leverage in Baghdad. It blocked the Russians. It gave us, leverage in Turkey. It even gave the Iranians understood that it was potential leverage on them. We walk off. It's interesting to me that for all the big talk, every time Donald Trump has been confronted with a shooting situation, he turns around and runs off.
Yeah, that's why I brought up this economic sanction thing. I agree with you. Boots on the ground matter. Human capital matters. Anytime that you're trying to bring safety and security to a region, that you cannot get the issues resolved with these very diverse ethnic groups, all looking for a piece of territory for self-determination and self-governance, and no one is in the position to be able to really negotiate giving that to them. And this may be the longest chess game of any region in the history of the world. That I keep trying to find, is there a checkmate move, and I don't ever see it.
And so, the issue is I liken it unto it's like an air mattress or a waterbed that's half full of water or air, and when you step on one end, the other end pops up.
Yep.
Okay?
You know
what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But it
same as the whack-a-mole. You hit one, another one pops up.
That is exactly what I call that. I'm giving a talk tonight to a bunch of academics and some other folks and some and military, et cetera, et cetera. And that's exactly what I call our policy of whack-a-mole.
Yeah.
But whack-a-mole and doing things like supporting the Kurds and having this position, there are affordable things we can do that are huge influence multipliers.
Yeah, those are the cheapest alternatives, right?
And that's the way you play the game.
And there's not a real attractive alternative. It's the lesser of all evils.
Right. And
Dr. Roby Barrett, I'm sorry I have to get to a break. I really appreciate your insight. And I really appreciate the amount of time you spent with us. This has been eye-opening for me. But I still think it's clear as mud at the end of the day.
No, you're right. But, Newell, that is exactly what the situation is. And you have to play it that way. If the problem is that.
Well, I've got to go. I apologize. Thank you so much, and we'll get you back on again. I've truly enjoyed this conversation. Stay with us. All I know is that there's probably going to be no end to this anytime soon. You add in there insufficient humanitarian aid, negligible stabilization assistance, corruption, people fighting for territory. All this is a dangerous jambalaya. That one of the byproducts of this is not heartburn, it is in an indirect way, is going to be the resurgence of insurgent activity and dealing with ISIS and everything else that goes along with that. This has been a value-added proposition for the United States in a very cheap way to try and bring some semblance of safety and security to the area, and all the while having forward-placed troop groups collecting intelligence information for us. And now that we've turned our backs on the Kurds, I'm not so sure that we're going to have a long-standing relationship whereby we're going to be able to trust them for that either. We'll be right back. On the Blue Runner opinion poll, how concerned are you that Turkey has launched an attack against Syria and U.S. allied Kurdish forces? 46% say very, 37% somewhat, and the remainder not at all. You know, a lot of folks are saying, why won't you criticize Trump? I don't know what to criticize him on yet. I'm trying to figure out exactly what's going on and what's happening there. What are the potential ramifications for this tug of war? I believe, like Dr. Roby Barrett, that boots on the ground matter and that human capital matters. And for the small force that we had there between 15 and 1800, albeit we're placing American lives at risk, the gain is something that we need to consider. Now it's time your chance to win a cool grand in the free cash giveaway contest. Now's your chance. The code word this hour is wallet. Text WALLET to 72881, 72881. Listen for the next code word right before the top of the hour, every hour, now through 4 p.m. Don't miss your chance to win $1,000 eight times a day in our Intercom National Cash Contest. Good luck from all of us at WWL. We never charge for text, but individual plan.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.